Hi, my name is Jane, and I'm an alcoholic.
Jane.
Thank you, Elaine. Oh, I should tell you, the custom here is the sobriety date. My sobriety date is January 8th, 1990. Thank you. Thanks for introducing me, Elaine, and for picking me up yesterday. As soon as Elaine got emotional here, I nearly started to cry at the table. I usually wait until I get to the podium to do that. Also, I would like to thank the committee, Paul, Harlan Says, Jim Oz, for all his emails, keeping in touch with me, and everyone else who's involved. Thank you for inviting me. It's really an honor to be here, and it's fantastic to be the first speaker, because when this is over, I can really exhale and enjoy myself. I really relate to the people sitting in the back row, especially the woman at the far corner in the back row, because that's where I would be to scope out the speaker, because if it was a deadly talk, I'd be out the door and no one would know. I don't know whether I'm blank or meditating. It's beautiful up here, I don't have to tell you, but this is my first trip to Seaside. I had a wonderful run on the beach this morning. It was balmy, nearly. I had to take off my long sleeve t-shirt, and the sun came out. I got back to the room. I had time to practice a few yoga postures, and the best part of that was Lila sang to me while I did that. And in the 12 years I've known her, she's never really been able to sing for me. She's very shy about that, but she has a fantastic voice. And I said to her, you could sing to me, because then it would be like being in a yoga class with the music. And so she did. She sang sad Irish songs, which of course is redundant. Thank you, Lila. Thanks for coming with me. Thanks for being my assistant here. Ha-ha, I just had to get that in. Anyway, the real fact is that if you asked me to come up here and stand on my head for 45 minutes, I would find a way to do it. Whatever I'm asked of in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm willing to do, because there's no way I could ever repay or make up for what has been given to me here for fun and for free. And I'd have to say that willingness is probably one of my best attributes today in terms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's because I came in here an absolutely desperate, hope to die, knew I never would alcoholic. I mean, if you had told me if you drink one more time you'll die, it wouldn't have mattered, because clearly that was the path I had chosen for myself anyway. But I think I have a fairly strong constitution, and I would have been the woman under the bridge without the bag. That's where I was going. And that's certainly where I was spiritually when I got here. I drank for 17 years. I was a daily drinker, except on those days when I held on with everything I had and didn't drink and counted it as one day. And I did that thousands of times. I remember once thinking, oh God, if I don't drink today, that would be 3 days. This is without Alcoholics Anonymous, of course. This is just me, desperate. So I quickly hit bottom. I was 18 years old when I started to drink, and I hit bottom when I was about 19. Turns out I'm precocious in more than one thing. However, like the book says, self-knowledge avails us nothing except self-knowledge. And I was, at 19, I remember joking with people, you know, that we should pack a cooler and go to an AA meeting. And I mean, it's really a shame, you know, that self-knowledge didn't avail me a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous at that point. I would have saved myself a lot of misery. But yet, that misery I don't regret, and that's been one of the most amazing promises in the book that has come true for me, that I don't regret the past. I admit, I have twinges of that when I do. And I think, well, what if? And usually the what if is, what if I hadn't been drunk during the law school admissions test? What if I actually had gone to law school? And then that result actually scares me more than not having gone. So, you know, it turns out that I'm most of the time content with my life today. My drinking was, I don't think, anything unusual. I didn't come from an alcoholic home, though most of my family are Irish, so there's a lot of alcoholics in the family. And it's a large family. I have 42 first cousins. So there's a lot of everything in that mix. How could there not be? But there's a lot of alcoholism there. But my parents were not. They were, I think, what social drinkers are. Two drinks maximum, and that was only on occasions. I think, I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I think I'm an alcoholic because, as Carl Jung said, alcoholics are people in search of God. That's what I've finally settled on. I wasn't someone really in search of religion. I wasn't really too keen on that. But I was always someone in search of God. My earliest recollections of a God consciousness was me making deals with God. Even as a little kid, I remember my grandmother breaking her hip, and I was... My grandmother and I were really tight. She lived across the street from us, and I thought, okay, God, if you do this and save my granny, I'll do that. Some mundane, piddly little kid thing, you know, but that was my concept there. Negotiation, trade, barter, this for that, right for wrong, black for white. Anyway, my drinking was... Like I said, I went right to the bottom rather quickly. I was a blackout drinker. I tended to make a lot of phone calls that I didn't remember. I said all sorts of things that I didn't remember. Woke up in strange places. Wrote bad checks. Lied, of course. Am I leaving anything else out? I never got arrested. Let me throw the yet in there. I should have been arrested. If life were fair, I'd be in jail. No question. Or I would have been in jail. I drank until I was 35. What a misery that was. I hit bottom and then I dragged along it for years. Years. I picture myself, I see the floor of the ocean with those little ridges of sand. And my rear end, just bumping along, bumping along, bumping along. I mean, it's hard to imagine that my life could have gotten worse, but it did. It wasn't so much on the outside, though it didn't look that terrific on the outside. But it was the inside. My insides were completely dark. The very last breath of spirit had been extinguished, and that was a long time ago. I had actually turned into a walking form of cement. I didn't know that until after I got here, and my sponsor, Catherine, related to me some years later how I looked that first day we met at the Crest coffee shop to discuss whether she would be my sponsor. And she said, "Your face never moved. You had no expression. You were just a block of cement sitting there." And that's what I was. I had no inside. I was all the whole that we talk about. That's all I was. I had nothing, no light, no sunlight of the spirit. Oh my God, I was 180 degrees away from the sunlight of the spirit. And to me, that's been my greatest gift here, is that I get to stand in the sunlight of the spirit and actually recognize those moments when I'm in that. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I think it was 1983, maybe 1984. I was living in California. That was another geographic. I had a lot of geographics. I actually was born in New Jersey. I'd like to say I grew up there, but I didn't. I grew up here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was born in New Jersey and lived there until I went away to college, and then drank my way out of at least two institutions that I can recall at this moment, and had a lot of geographics. Not to any place smart like the Caribbean or Hawaii, places like Boston, like Vermont, where you could stumble out at doors and pass out and freeze, and they would find you 6 months later when the snow melted. And I went to places, of course, where drinkers went. Killington, Vermont was a big drinking, skiing town, and I was too busy drinking to do much skiing. But I came to California, and my uncle stopped over to see me one morning, and he opened the front door and stepped over me. And he looked down and he said, "I think you should go to Alcoholics Anonymous." And this isn't even a man who at that time had any real faith in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a health nut whose main objection to AA was that people smoked. I mean, who cares if they smoke? I mean, I'm killing myself. Tobacco isn't part of my, the worry for me. So I went to a meeting. I had, of course, a few drinks first, and I went to this meeting where there were, it's all so foggy, but there were a lot of big, hairy men there, like a lot of hair coming out from the top of the T-shirt, and big and burly, and motorcycles parked out front, and I thought, no way, I don't belong here. And in fact, I didn't belong there then. I wasn't ready to be there. They say if Alcoholics Anonymous were for people who wanted it, we wouldn't get a seat. But fortunately, for people who need it, we wouldn't get a seat, but it's for people who want it. And so that was my one brief little blind date with AA in 1984, and then I came back in 1989. In the fall of 1989, this time with all my soul, with everything inside of me, I was so defeated, so surrendered, I so wanted to stop drinking. And yet, I was in that awful place of couldn't drink. It made me sick at that point, and I was drunk on a thimbleful when, of course, previously I had, the tolerance of three pirates with wooden legs. And I was also in the place where I could not drink. The misery of it, the misery of it. I don't have to really describe that to you. So I started to go to Alcoholics Anonymous in September of 1989, and I was a regular member then until I got sober on January 8th of 1990. So however many months that is, 4 or 5 months of raising my hand as a newcomer. I was Jane with 3 days, and the next week I was Jane with 2 days, and I kept coming to meetings. And because of that experience, I really understand and value the third tradition, which states that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And today I consider that third tradition in other areas of my life where I'm not perfect, where it's progress, not perfection, but I have a desire to move towards something. So I still feel like I'm a part of and I'm still on the path. I kept coming to meetings. Finally, a woman sitting 2 seats away from me turned to me and handed me her phone number and said, "Before you take a drink, call me." And I thought the phrase, "take a drink," was so impossibly quaint that I called her. I had never taken a drink in my life. That wasn't the style with which I drank. I drank in one long, fluid motion. You never saw one bottle empty and the next bottle coming toward me. You just turned around and suddenly the kitchen of your gorgeous apartment had a corner filled with beer bottles, a mountain of them. And so I called Catherine and she became my sponsor. And I drank once more after that. And everything I see makes sense to me now. Every slip, every relapse, whatever you want to call it, was important, was necessary to me. It wasn't my time, it wasn't my story to get sober when I was 22. My time, my story was to get sober when I was 35 on January 8th, 1990. And when I finally did get sober, I was utterly surrendered. And at the same time, absolutely determined to stay here, no matter what it took, no matter what. I thought when I first got sober that I would hire a hitman or woman, whatever, to just shoot me in the back of the head should I ever take a drink again, because I didn't want to live my life like that. I'd rather die than drink. That's what it came down to me. So Catherine became my sponsor. She was wonderful. She still is wonderful. She lives in Washington State, and she took me through the 12 steps my first year. I couldn't wait to do the 12 steps because I was terrified of drinking. And I said to her, I remember I had about 30 days, I told her I thought I should do step 4. I was ready to do that. And she said, oh, well, let's just wait a little bit on that. Now, I know there's evidence in the big book that, you know, you took your man in the old days. You took your man. You had a little chat with him. You shared your experience. You gave him the book. And you told him, read the book and meet me tomorrow. But however, you know, I did it at the direction of my sponsor because I really trusted her judgment, and she was just right for me. She was firm. She was the iron fist in the velvet glove. She had all the trappings of softness and easiness, and I'm not an authority figure, and you don't have to rebel. And then the parenthesis is, these suggestions, you're going to do them. She told me I had to call her every day for the first year. And during that first year, I moved. And 2 or 3 days went by, and I didn't call her. And she left me a message, and she said, I didn't know there was an ordinance in Los Feliz, my new neighborhood, that said you didn't have to call your sponsor every day. So with that kind of humor, it so worked for me. And she gave me a completely solid foundation in the steps. And I went to 90 meetings in 90 days, my first 90 days, and that gave me a real appetite for meetings. I'm still that way. The more I do things, the more I want to do things, whether they're good things or not so good things. The more I do it, the more I want to do it. So those 90 meetings in 90 days gave me this absolute love for meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that I still have today. And when that first year, I remember there was a meeting on Monday evenings where everyone went around the room and gave their name and length of sobriety. And that kept me busy because I kept weighing how many people had less time. Well, everyone had more time. But eventually there were maybe 10 people in the room that had less time. And I had this false sense of that I was making progress. But it was still a sense. And it didn't really matter because I just loved coming. And I never wanted to miss a meeting because I was afraid of missing something. My first year, I taught a bilingual kindergarten, and I came home very tired after that job, and I finally decided that it was safe for me to nap from 4 to 5 p.m. because nothing in the world happened from 4 to 5. I wouldn't miss anything. I didn't want to miss anything anywhere because I had missed 17 years of my life for the most part. I mean, I didn't miss out on any misery. I got more than my share of that. But I missed out on everything. I didn't want to miss anything in a meeting. And I didn't want to miss the personalities. I didn't want to miss the new friends I made. And I didn't want to miss the message. I believed utterly what they told me, that I could never drink or use again, no matter what. Recently, I was talking to this woman who is sober for about 2 years, and she, you know, she has a lot of stuff on her plate with an ill mother and a mother who's one of us, but not in the rooms. And she said, well, are you part of the old school that believes that you can't drink or use no matter what? I said, what do you mean the old school? It's the only school. just pissed me off. Two schools? No. The only thing I'm really black and white on about in my life is sobriety. It's the first thing in my life. You either are or you aren't. You're either on the boat or you're not. So I don't want to hear about two schools. Because if there's two schools, I don't feel safe here. I want to be on the boat with the people who say, we don't drink ever again, one day at a time. Because that's what I want. So, well, now that tangent took me off. Must have had something to do with being a newcomer. 90 meetings in 90 days. Falling in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, listening to the message they told me I couldn't drink no matter what. And I heard a lot of people get up to podiums and share what their no matter what's were. The death of their mother, the death of their father, their husband, their wives, their boyfriends, their girlfriends, their children. The loss of their jobs, their house burns down, their shoelaces break. The book talks about that, that we're pretty well equipped to deal with the big stuff, the big crisis. But it's the small things, it's the broken shoelaces that can really push me over the edge. They also told me not to leave before the miracle. And they tricked me. They said, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle. So you start thinking, oh, what's another 5 minutes to get a miracle? I've had more miracles in Alcoholics Anonymous than I could possibly count. If I define a miracle as a shift in perspective, it's sort of like pi, the number that goes on forever. When I first got here, I thought not drinking was really, if that's all it was going to be great. Not to wake up with a hangover, to know where my car was in the morning, to have a car, all of that would have been just fabulous. As it turns out, I'm a bit more greedy than that. So after about, I don't know, maybe after the first year, I started to feel like I need more. I need more. And the more was I needed a bigger connection to a power greater than myself, because that's the only thing that fixes me. Like I said, I had that first year with Catherine as my sponsor. She was 5 years sober. I thought that was an eternity. I remember when she asked me to give her her cake for 5 years, I was just knock-kneed. I was blown away that someone could have 5 years. And this was the dedication that she had to her program, that she has had herself all lined up to take a leave of absence from her job for a year. She bought herself a brand new 300-foot-long RV. It seemed that long. It had a camera to show you where you were reversing to. And she and her friend and her dog were going to take a year and travel all around the United States. And they were all set to go. The only thing holding her back was my first birthday, January 8th, 1991. And she waited. That still moves me so much. She put that on hold because it was more important for her to be there for my first birthday. There's nowhere else to get that except here. Like I said, if not drinking were all I got, it would still be lifetimes more than I had. And yet that's only the tip of the iceberg. And she gave me a really thorough, solid foundation in the steps and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she didn't do it through preaching, she did it through example. She was attraction rather than promotion. And she still is. I don't know if I'm allowed to call her my sponsor now because we've become really good friends, but she still is. I don't care what she says. She's still the person I call when my mother died, when my sister-in-law died, when some baby of mine drives me absolutely mad. All the big events, every big decision I have, every real heartbreak I have, I call her. And she's moving back to California, to the San Luis Obispo area, so I'm already plotting how we can each drive halfway and meet for coffee, or maybe even find a meeting halfway. But what I've gotten here is so much more than not drinking, and as it should be. The literature tells me that drinking is not my problem, that drinking is but a symptom of my problem, that my problem is my inability to live life on life's terms. And that's still my problem. I'm really grateful, very grateful, that I don't have any desire, urge, inkling, even a thought to drink or use. Though I will confess, I had a vodka dream on Wednesday night. Yes, indeed, folks, your first speaker at this wonderful conference had a drunk dream two nights ago. And I love that. You know, it's just testament to the power of my disease. And I was also told that drunk dreams are really good things because it's a way for me to work this out subconsciously rather than actually having to experience the horror of drinking again. Like I said, I still have the contract out, so bullet to the back of the head. What I got here was a lot more than that. And the way I've gotten it is slowly, which has felt okay, because just being on the path and being with all of you is the place I want to be. And I've got it through first the study of the steps, my first year doing the steps at the direction of my sponsor, and then when I was about 4 years sober, exactly when I was 4 years sober, I joined a group of women, and we formed not a step study, but a step practice. And the step study I liken to thinking about something until I actually have convinced myself that I've done it. I have library books overdue, and they're stacked by the front door. And I think about returning them two or three times a day until I'm confident that they've been returned. And then when I get the dunning letter in the mail, I'm shocked. But that's how it is for me, the difference between study and practice. That was an exclamation point. And so with this group of women, we meet once a month and we practice one step a month. Now, it doesn't mean I'm stuck on one for all of January and I can't go on to the hope of the second step or the faith of the third step. But that once a month on a Friday evening, we meet and we practice that step. We read the literature in the big book that pertains to the step, and then, of course, we read the step in the 12 and 12. And what that really does for me is it gives me a way, a disciplined way, to read the 12 and 12 and the big book every year. Because left to my own devices, I'm a bathroom reader. The book's on the shelf over the throne, and when I sit down, I open it up, and it's a snatch here and a snippet there and a paragraph there. Which is okay. I accept that about myself. So I love this, because when I do this with this group of women, I then do it the following day, which is a Saturday, with the people I sponsor. So it really keeps me in the book. It really keeps me in the solution, because for me today, I don't have the desire to drink, but I have a problem with my thinking. When I read the big book today in the 12 and 12, every time I come across the word drinking, I substitute thinking. I was told that if I made the decision today to drink, that I would have made that decision cold, stone, sober. I nearly fell off my chair when I realized the meaning of that for me. So clearly the book is right. The problem centers in my mind. So I have a problem with my thinking. And my thinking can go from okay, good, have it turned over, and the next moment I'm totally nuts. And I'm enshrined, engulfed wrapped, enveloped in fear. Doesn't have to be any big fears either, just fears. The book tells me there's 100 forms of fear. I think it's a typo, they left off a zero. Someone else told me there's really only two fears, loud noises and heights. I thought, these people haven't lived, come on. I more subscribe to the idea that the only two fears are, I will lose what I have, or I won't get what I want. That sums it up for me. But then I manifest them in all sorts of sneaky little ways. So it's been through the steps. It's been through the steps. And coming to meetings reminds me about the steps. And coming to meetings gives me your experience, strength, and hope. And it shows me how you live life on life's terms. And it inspires me to want to practice and perfect my spiritual life. I realize that I'm powerless over drugs and alcohol. It made my life utterly unmanageable. But I'm also powerless today over the way I think. And that can make me unmanageable in a moment. I've become a little more practiced at recognizing when I'm unmanageable, recognizing when I'm irritable, discontented, annoyed, impatient, trying to control you, judging you. Oh, my Lord, judging you, which stems, of course, from judging me. If I'm judging myself, I'm guaranteed to be judging you, and it's really hard for me not to judge myself. That is a full-time job, keeping that particular street clean, not judging myself. I have a God that I believe doesn't judge me, so I really want to align myself with that vision, and I can only do that through the steps. So I have the honesty to admit that I'm utterly powerless over the way I think, and that my thinking is completely unreliable most of the time. And that's why I need Catherine, and I have some other people that I have known and have known me a long time in my sobriety that I'm 100% honest with, that really know how I think and know my patterns and know my history. I mean, there's people out there that don't need the steps to live their lives this way. My parents didn't need the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to live their lives the same way. I don't know what they had. I mean, I can't imagine it was the Catholic Church, but that's what they say. So, I believe that. It worked for them. You know, I was the kid who ran into the confessional acting like the priest to make jokes with my friends and had the nun, you know, apoplectic, having a stroke, telling me I was brash, bold, brazen, and then I thanking her for that. I think the book describes that in the doctor's opinion that our outstanding characteristic is defiance. And I've always had that. I'm a little less so defiant today, you know. I'm still questioning, but I'm more interested in going with the flow. You know, I'm tired. 51, I'm tired. Went through menopause, can't sleep every night all night long, I'm tired. It's easier, just go with the flow. It's a softer, easier way. And then in step two, I have the hope that I will be restored. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I don't even have the belief. I have the knowledge, because I have been restored from an absolutely hopeless alcoholic to someone standing at a podium at the 24th annual North Coast Roundup. Miracle. Complete miracle. I don't belong here. I don't know how it happened. We were driving from the airport in Portland yesterday, and I was entranced by the trees. And I thought, this is like a dream. This is really like a dream. How did I get from where I was on January 7th, 1990, to here? How did I get here? It's not all me. I don't believe that I had nothing to do with it. because God does for me what I can't do for myself, which implies that what I can do for myself, I must do. But in conjunction with my God, that's how I got here. Aligning my will with God's will. So I have the hope that I can be restored to sanity by a power greater than myself in step two. And for me today, it has to do with restoring my thinking. My thinking is making me unmanageable and I'm powerless over it. I need to be restored to some form of sanity. And for me, that form of sanity can only stem from when I'm consciously connected with a power greater than myself. I like to call that power the great spirit of the universe. The book also uses creative intelligence, friend. I like the great spirit of the universe because I cannot conjure any visual to go with that. I don't get the old guy in the long white beard holding a staff. That's good for me. If I can imagine it, it's not big enough to cure my alcoholism. It's not big enough to cure the soul sickness that the book describes that I have. Because it's not about drinking, it's about my inability to live life on life's terms, and that's because I have a soul sickness. And that's, I will always have that. And I only get a daily reprieve based on my spiritual condition. And I want to be in condition spiritually. That's the best part about it for me. I want that. I'm actively reaching for it. So I have the hope that I can be restored in the second step, and then I have the faith in the third step to turn it over. I never really knew what I was turning over for years. I thought I was turning over the situation. And sometimes I am turning over the situation, but underlying that situation, I'm turning over how I think about that situation. I'm turning over my thinking. The stinking thinking. Was that one of the slogans that I would see on the walls in meetings? Stinking thinking? P.S. Your thinking stinks. That's what I'm turning over, and I have the faith to do that. It says in step three that faith without works is dead, and so I must go directly to step four. Brilliant how they wrote these in order. Really brilliant. You know, I mean, I used to have the Band-Aid theory. You know, I would pick one that I thought applied to that particular moment in my life, and I would stick it on me. Oh, I think that's a 7. Smack. But it's not a 7 without 1 through 6, and it's still not a 7 without 8 through 12. I'm meant to do all the steps in the order that they're written, and it's graceful and intelligent and brilliant the way one follows the other. So in step 4, I have the courage to take a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. The book also tells me that I should note my assets, that we're never to take one only in red ink. And I'm never to take it to then use it against myself, to bludgeon myself with it. I just want to seek the unsaleable goods, because it's the unsaleable goods that make me miserable. So when I take a 4-step today, it's always balanced. The hardest 4th step I did was really to write an inventory of my positive attributes, or what's good about my life, or what's good about the people in my life. Rather than looking at the glass half full, how about the glass half full? Thank you for that look of horror, Paula. What the hell is she talking about? I think also, I don't know where it is. It's either in, well, obviously, it's either in the 12 and 12 or the big book. Go find it. There's a great passage there about avoiding the deliberate manufacture of misery. Ooh, that's me. Ooh, I'm just a little factory all unto myself. Working ceaselessly, tirelessly. 24 hours a day, cranking out that misery. And so someone mentioned this at a meeting Tuesday night, and I thought, why don't I deliberately manufacture euphoria? Joy, ecstasy, delirium, contentedness, serenity. Ooh. Why? I'm in the habit. Part of it is I'm in the habit of manufacturing misery. It's one of my old ideas. I have a lot of old ideas. The book tells me that, and I'm good with it. I agree. Filled with old ideas. So I take this fourth step the first time with my sponsor at her direction, and of course, all of you are on the page. And my part's there. My resentments and my part in that. But since I joined this little step practice, what I do every April, and I like to do it early in the month because it gives me relief, I write a fear inventory because I really believe that that's the root of my problem today, fear. And so I write a fear inventory, and I list the fears I have today. Just today. There's enough. I don't really have to go digging around in the past. I don't have to project into the future. I'm good at that too, though. But I just list them today. And then I list those fears, and then I make a little column next to those fears, and I decide whether the fear is real or imagined. The book describes this as real or fancied. Another quaint word, fancied. Real or imagined. And the next column is it a worry or a judgment? Generally speaking, if it happened in the past, it's a judgment. If it's yet to happen, clearly it's a worry. And then I use the seven deadly sins as a guide for me to identify how I manifest those fears. The book talks about being, inconsiderate, impatient, self-seeking, selfish, that sort of thing. Those terms are a little ambiguous for me. I could slide in and out of those categories pretty easily. But the seven deadly sins, even though I don't believe in sin as a concept, the seven deadlies work for me. Greed, lust, anger, pride, envy, sloth, gluttony. They work for me because they're really obvious what they are. And I've come to learn in the last few years that sometimes the opposite of that deadly sin might apply to me. Like the opposite of gluttony could be anorexia or some form of stringent denial that's out of balance. So I use those seven deadly sins to see how I really operate. And then from that list, I see a lot of my old ideas on paper. I also realize that 90-some percent of my fears are imagined. I just have simply made them up. And then I proceed to exhaust myself, worrying about them and operating under them and creating misery for myself and those people around me. That was mind-blowing to me the first time I did that, to realize 90-some percent of my fears are imagined. They are not real, Jane. Get it? They're not real, Jane. You've made them up. You are deliberately manufacturing your own misery. But until I put them on paper, I don't see it. And when I read that inventory to Catherine or one of my other trusted people in AA, I get to see my pattern and I see my most predominant old ideas. I have a lot of old ideas, as I said. Probably the most fundamental old idea, the most primary old idea I have is that something outside of me can fix me. Doesn't work. Shopping, car, job, relationship, food, whatever it is, it doesn't work. The only thing that works for me is a power greater than myself and having a conscious contact with that power. It. End of story. When I see all those old ideas, I was told that I needed to make a new idea for myself. Take the most predominant old idea. Another one is that I'm not enough. That's a universal size. I guarantee that will fit everyone in this room sometime today. I am not enough. So if you don't, you know, if you're just lazy and you don't want to really figure out a new idea for yourself, try that one. So what I do is I give myself a new idea as a result of that fourth step, and I preface it with, please help me to pause. The book talks a lot about pausing. If I don't pause, I don't have the trigger to go for the solution. I go to misery. I don't go for the solution of the steps. Please help me to pause and know that I am enough. I write them down in my 12 and 12 on the blank page because I have this little thing where I like chronology and I like to see how things change over the years. And sometimes I keep the same idea for a couple of years. When my mother got diagnosed with cancer and she was on the East Coast and I was on the West Coast, my new idea was, please help me to pause and know that my love is enough, because it couldn't be there all the time. My current new idea is, please help me to pause and trust the spiritual direction of my life. Ooh, that's a big one. That's a big one. I mean, it's all spiritual direction, but how about me recognizing that and breathing and saying, okay, let me trust God to take me where I'm supposed to go. So when I have the integrity to take step 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, it really makes me feel a part of. It certainly did the very first time I took step 5 with Catherine. It made me feel a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today it makes me feel a part of the solution. I'm in the action of what the solution is. I don't want to be in the problem anymore. I want to be in the problem as little as possible, and I want to get right to the solution for entirely selfish reasons, because I'm miserable in the problem. In step 6, it says, what does it say? Became entirely willing or ready, and or ready, I don't know which word, to have God remove all these defects of character. For a long time, I didn't know what that meant, really. I understand the words, but I don't understand what they really mean. Because for a long time, I had the words of steps 6 and 7 here in my head, but they hadn't made that long trip down to my heart. Or even better for me, way down into my guts. Because that's where I feel everything first. I feel it in my guts. So I learned today I'm comfortable with the idea that step 6 for me is all about acceptance. I see all my old ideas on that 4th step. I see all the fears I have. I'm riddled with those fears. They control my life, and I'm okay. I accept that. I accept that's who I am today, because until I can accept myself where I am and who I am today, there's no point in asking for help to change, and that's what step 7 is. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Again, could not figure that out for the longest time. Then someone translated for me. They said, Jane, it means please help me. So that's what I need help with. Thanks to the 4th step and the 5th step and discussing it with Catherine, I know exactly what I need help with in the 7th step, what I need to accept in 6 and what I need the help with in 7. And then 8, made a list of all persons I had harmed. And today, thank God, I don't harm people nearly as much in an outward way. I mean, I think awful things about you. Truly, awful things. But, you know, I have the wherewithal or the restraint of pen and tongue not to act on them. And that's, you know, that's pretty good. I mean, that's progress. So often in 8, you know, but I'm willing. Again, I have the willingness in 8 to clean it up. And in 9, I make direct amends to those I've harmed, except when it would harm them or others. I need always help with them or others because, again, when I was new, I discussed everything on my 8th step with my sponsor to know when I had to make the amends and when I didn't. And I can report that there wasn't one amends she told me not to make. I was also told that when I was new that amends does not mean I'm sorry. Amend means to change the behavior. Sorry doesn't cut it. That I should take my checkbook with me when I go to make an amends. I have to be part of the solution, take the action of being on the path of solution. So my amends today are not always They're hardly ever having to do with me really having to say anything to you. But often it's about how I have to amend my thinking. There I am, back to that thinking. I have to change the way I think. To change the way I think about myself, about my life, about what's happening in my life. And then that automatically changes how I think about you. Because if I'm okay with myself, I'm okay with you. Live and let live. I didn't get that for a long time either. I got the let live, but I didn't get the live. I have to be comfortable in my own skin, breathing in and out, before I can allow you the same peace. And in 10, it says, we continue to take personal inventory and promptly admitted it when we were wrong. That's really easy for me today. Again, selfishly motivated, I feel miserable when I don't do it. So I want to do it as quickly as possible to clean up my side of the street. And 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact. I love the 11th step. I've begun to meditate in somewhat of a formal way. My informal way is to work in the garden. And that works too. There's, you know, for as many ways that people do it, there are even more ways to meditate. I don't know. I don't have the answer there. Whatever works for me on any given day works. I'm just glad to be part of that too. I'm glad to be a seeker. I'm glad to be someone in search of God. And if I hadn't been an alcoholic, I wouldn't be. I don't know what I'd be, but I wouldn't be this. I wouldn't be who I am. And I like who I am today. It's a miracle, really. In the 11th step, I have also developed a practice of asking questions. It talks about that in the inventory, what sorts of questions to ask. And so I ask questions, but not about big things, sometimes about big things, about little things, like what color to paint the wall. I ask things about the shoestrings, the shoelaces of life, those little things. And what do I do? When do I call her? And what do I say? The calls I don't want to make. It's hard, so hard for me to be a sponsor sometimes because I don't want to be honest with them. Oh, would you like to have a sponsor who's not honest with you? Yeah. I don't mean someone who lies to them, but someone who doesn't tell them the truth. Because it's hard. It's really hard to tell people the truth. But so I write these questions. And I write, Dear Great Spirit, I write the date, April 7th, 2006. Dear Great Spirit. What do I do about so-and-so? Is there anything more I need to clean up my side of the street? Should I call her? If so, when? And if I call her, what do I say? Because these are the things that can just go on the tape loop in my mind again, 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 again. I can't be present with you or with myself if I'm thinking about when I'm supposed to call so-and-so. And so I write these questions, and I use initials. I use the first initial of every word, and I write DGS, Dear Great Spirit. And then I zip through the questions, and the trick I must adhere to is never to write the question in a way that gives me the answer. Because I don't want my answer. I want the answer from the Great Spirit of the universe. And I use initials because it's quick. Don't know why I'm in a rush, but it's quick. And I use initials because I can write it on the margin of a newspaper while sitting in a cafe, and you can't read it. Even better, I can't reread it. I can't go back and edit, censor, delete, nothing. I have to just sign it. Thank you for my life and sobriety. I love and need you, Jane. And then I crinkle it up and throw it out. And that's just symbolic of turning it over. Just going to give it to God and wait for the answer and hope that I can stay open to receive the answer. I think that's the purpose of the 12 steps for me, is to clear the channels so that I can receive God's grace. And in the 12th step, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry the message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. Carrying the message is a lot easier than the second part. Carrying the message, we all get trained. At least I did. I got trained pretty early to put out my hand, to give my phone number, to say yes when asked. But to practice these principles in all my affairs, that's a trick. That's a big order. But the book tells us that no one can adhere to perfect, no one has perfect adherence to these principles. We're just practicing. I've learned a whole new meaning to the word practice through the steps. For my whole life, practice to me implied a huge deficit that I had, else why would I have to practice? So I was really not willing to practice. Just like studying, I didn't want to study because I thought if I don't know it, what is the point of having to study? And in fact, I didn't have to study that much. So that just reinforced that old idea. That old idea that really deprives me of things that are good. So I've learned that practice is something in and of itself a wonderful thing to do. The practice isn't taking me anywhere. The practice is and of itself something to be desired. So I've learned this through practicing the steps. I've learned then to practice yoga. Not be perfect, just practice and like it. I've learned to practice my writing, and I've learned to practice the principles in little bitty steps, in little bitty spoonfuls. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me more than I could ever tell you. It's given me an interior life that's more than I could have ever imagined. It's given me a life. There's no way I could ever repay it, and I'll be eternally grateful for the steps and all of you. Thank you.